This is a production of Cornell University.
Student Assembly Meeting, February 12th, 2009.
Greg from CIC is coming.
I don't know.
I don't know if it's a student or faculty or a
people.
He's
got a
big guy.
I don't know. We'll ask. Hi, everyone. I did that twice. Welcome. It is 4:46 p.m. Calling the Student Assembly Meeting to order. It's February 12th, 2009. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Here.
Here.
Who?
The long phone.
Excuse. All set? All right, thank you very much. Next, we have approval of the minutes from February 5th, 2009. I'm going to call for acclamation. Is there a second? Is a second? Any dissent? Minutes have been approved. Thank you. Now, we now have open microphone. Anyone in the audience who would like to bring anything to the student assembly's attention that is not currently on the agenda, please do so now. Welcome as well. Nope. All right. We're all set. Moving on to announcements and reports, we have a Greek update by Liaison Miller. Great, thank you. Any questions for Alan? Moving on, we have an Appropriations Committee report from VP Mezzi.
The Appropriations Committee met on Tuesday to discuss a couple different things that we're talking about, and the Appropriations Committee voted unanimously to fund ZimRide for a year. At a price of $4,500, which is a $5,000 discount from the full program. So we will have both the carpool application on Facebook and also the website application as well for those people that don't use Facebook. That's open to Cornell students, faculty, and staff. Then also an update, the task force meeting for the student organization, for the registered student organizations will start Tuesday at 4 p.m. Those will be an every Tuesday meeting at 4 p.m. So just an FYI for that.
Where will that be?
Location to be announced. But I will let everyone know before Tuesday.
And I guess I'll let Tony's kind of been spearheading the gym right thing, if you have anything else to fill in.
I just said I think that what you guys should know in terms of this being online at the spending, our goal in the long term is to collect data from the school package that John graciously offered us as a Cornell alum, so we kind of want to thank you. And hopefully when the financial situation of the university is settled down and the Dean of Students and Susan Murphy know how much money they're actually going to have for student programming, in the future we hope that we can help split this cost as a number of our peer institutions do. So I know that it is a large amount of money. We have to put a lot of time and consideration into this, and hopefully down the road we'll be able to have it funded by the administration.
Now, again, the Appropriations Committee did decide to approve this expense. I just wanted to give you all the point of information. The action is done, and anyone from the Assembly can disapprove an action, committee's action by 2/3. I just want to let you know. Next on the agenda, we have Zimride, the continuation of Zimride announcement, and the PR marketing plan, VP Junowitz and the Communications Committee. Take it away.
Okay, we met on Tuesday, and we came up with a little bit of a PR plan to promote Zimride. First and foremost, we're obviously going to do sun ads, Facebook ads, and we're also going to send out alerts throughout the listserv and the Facebook group, but these guys also came up with some pretty creative ideas that I wanted to share with you. So.
Can you guys state your name and year for the record? Awesome, thank you. Are there any questions for the Communications Committee? Representative Craig.
I know that Representative Zavakosan is not here, but I was wondering perhaps if you guys are able to, instead of maybe a Sun ad, writing a Sun editorial or a new sort of column about this, because I think people would, I know I have people over the ads, and people would definitely go to the editorial section and will see that at a greater rate than, say, in the ad section.
Representative Stalin.
Yeah, I guess this is more for the Appropriations Committee's funding. Is there like some sort of itemized budget available for like how the $4,500 is to be used?
Yeah, to pay for the service. I mean, it's purely a service fee and setup fee because the website that they use is customized with like the Cornell look to it a little bit, and they create these custom things for you. So it's having that interface and also the ability to use the service to be restricted within the Cornell community.
I wanted to add, John Zimmer, who's a Cornell alum, also says that he will finance the PR campaign for it. So there you go. Any further questions for Greg or this Communications Committee? Okay, thanks very much. Thanks, guys. Next, we have an elections announcement by Director McDermott.
So just briefly, I wanted to make sure we all knew that there were 53 packets signed out as of noon today, so that's really great and all I can is. We don't have information to say about the record number, but everyone in the office said that it's considered high, and they don't know if it's a record, but they think it is. So that's really great. An email has gone out to all of those candidates that signed up in packets. To remind them, the same thing I'm going to remind all of you now, 12:30 on Monday is the deadline for all election materials. Please do not miss that deadline. And Elections Committee's members announce it to you Monday afternoon and Tuesday morning and Tuesday all day. If you have any free time, we need to run all of the signatures. We have all 53 people turn in their petitions. We're looking at quite a few signatures and IDs that we're going to have to be running. So please schedule any free time on those 2 days to come into the office and run numbers. That's election committee members only. If you're a candidate who's running, you are not allowed to help us. If you're not running, then you're not on the election committee, you can come help us.
Any questions for Mike? Okay. Any further announcements and reports that is not on the agenda? All right, moving on to business of the day. We have, I don't know if we're ready over here, we have an email server changes presentation.
You seem ready?
Just a minute. Sure. Is Mike Walsh here? Trustee Walsh here? He's not. We're going to go to a transfer survey email discussion by, what? Yeah. By Representative Brockman. You have 5 minutes.
Okay, so in front of you is the email I sent out to all transfer students, as well as the survey, which the board needs to do. The only difference between, we have two surveys, which ratify according to last year. Transfers and transfers in the fall of 08 and spring of 09 will get the survey. It's identical except for the first two questions. Before fall of 08. And it's relatively straightforward. We had some policy people work on it, make sure to not include any biases, especially in the email itself. You can see there is no bias. We're not stating the committee's view on the housing initiatives, but we simply want to gauge people's opinions, and hopefully it will be approved.
Okay, thank you. Again, Andrew and I did want to make sure this came through the student assembly because we're hoping that when the registrar sends it out, it will be from the student assembly or the student assembly or perhaps Andrew in the, sender subject. The speaker's list is now open for questions, comments, or anything. VP Mezzi.
just had a quick question. I don't know if all you're asking is 10 questions. But one thing that I know is a little concerning for transfers is associating with a class of, like I'm class 2009, and there's a listserv that's created, basically all the freshmen get added on, but transfers are kind of lost and they're not identified with the class of or don't have the option to identify with. So I was wondering if there's any way to ask, have you sought out associating with a class of, X listserv or email list or in any of that kind of way.
We've been informed by JPA, the registrar, that he will be able to send this out specifically to transfer students and will be able to separate them in terms of transfer students from follow away in 09, the rest of them who, up until 09.
That's not my question, though.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
You want to gauge transfers sentiment, like where do they identify?
Where do they identify in the classes?
That's not really the goal of the survey. I think the goal of the survey is simply about housing and how they feel their first year living experience was. But that is an issue of concern for transfers.
I'd say it is appropriate though if you want to like recommend a question for him, see if you can draft one, and before we end discussion, you can suggest Andrew hasn't submitted it yet to the registrar, but I'd also note that if the question is something like which class do you identify with, we're not going to know, am I correct? We're not going to know which class they actually are registered as, or are we? Or we don't know. We want to make sure that the question is
gets the appropriate response.
Right. All right, Representative Stein.
First of all, I would just like to echo VP Mezzi's comments. This is something I had tried to deal with last year, and I was told it was utterly impossible by the class council to let transfer students fill in themselves in class. But on topic again, I think that this is great. I've already filled out the survey, but I'm not even sure what we're discussing. Are we approving this or disapproving this, or are we just talking about it?
We're approving it because in order to get it sent out to the registrar with the subject line from the essay, it should be approved on the essay.
Well, then I urge everyone to support this. There's absolutely nothing to lose, and I can't imagine a single transfer student who would be bothered by this email.
Thank you, Representative Kumar.
I just want to echo Representative Stein's sentiment. I also want to say, you know, great job with the committee at getting everybody involved. I think you reached out to a lot of different people who have been working on the survey before this committee founded. So great job with reaching out to everybody, including the wider range. And ready for a recommendation or anything.
Working on it.
All right.
Thank you, Representative Salem.
Yeah, definitely a good idea. I just thought of something. So since David Gaines can email all the transfers, does a transfer listserv already exist there?
You know, I'm not sure. I can only assume he has one, but we can't have access to this unless you go through a number of steps, and first step is getting to the president.
No, I was just suggesting maybe a possible idea would be to create like a change.
We are actually in the process. We're up to about 170 names my year alone, and then I think we have 300 from other years. So we are working on that.
And then just to add, you know, I know we live in listserv land, but how the register works, I mean, they'll just, they like put in a magic formula that says email all ILREs or email all. So they have the capability of doing that because they're the central hub of all the information, but there's no like permanent listserv for all that. But he does have the capability of emailing all transfers, for example. Yeah. Anyone else that would like to speak on the first speaker's list? VP Basil.
Hi. Call the question.
Good, I call the question, sure. Is any dissent?
No.
Dissent.
I wanted to ask.
Okay, I will not recognize the motion and then give it a minute.
So my one thing is just to kind of reiterate where I'm coming from is when you sign up for the transfer, you're not on a class council or class of listserv anywhere. You're just kind of out there in Cornell land. And one of the things I think is important is there's a lot of things that bring the class together that you identify with while you're here on campus and then after you graduate. And I think it's important to have a process for transfer students to identify with the class. So I would like to just kind of throw out three questions that I have. The first would be, have you selected the class you wish to identify with? Do you currently identify with a class of X council? And if so, are you receiving class council emails? Class Councils is a byline-funded organization. You know, if we took in 600 some transfers last year that are paying for Class Councils but aren't able to identify with a Class Council, I think that that's a little bit of an issue, and I think that's a really pressing question because that's money that they're spending, but they have no idea how to take advantage of that. So those are the three questions that I would throw out there for you.
I agree that that's an issue, but I think that's an issue for a separate survey. I think it's important for this survey to be limited to 10 questions, so it's not that, you know, some people will say, well, I'm not taking the time to do that, and, well, yeah. I think it's a separate issue, and I think we could use the same survey to kind of propel that issue within the transfer committee, but I don't think it's good for the future.
My personal opinion, then, too, on the other side of that is I don't think you're going to get another survey just because I don't think the registrar is going to keep sending stuff out, you know, transfer issue, transfer issue, because there's going to be essay, general student body issues that we're going to want to address via email eventually. You know, so we don't want to, you know, bombard everybody on the campus with multiple emails.
You're right. However, right now, on our personal listserv, we're able to get this thing out to transfers. At least 200 in my own grid, and about, I think we can get that to 500 or something between all of us to other grade programs. So I don't think it's necessary for to just throw it on a different survey.
Representative Garcia Bodine.
I just want to say that I personally am a transfer and I don't feel confused as to what you are part of. So I just feel like there are greater issues that need to be addressed that I think the survey should address, that I think that this kind of issue can be addressed later on. I just feel that what you have is an issue.
Representative Andrews.
I would like to call the question. Did you have something else? Or?
I just wanted to ask her if she receives a class of email. Do you receive those?
Yes.
Okay.
That's fine.
That's fine.
No, I don't have any questions.
Can I offer appointment information?
Do you have a point of information?
I do. I have one that I'd like to offer to everyone else. But I
no,
can
no, no.
raise it. Okay, fine. I have a point of information for Andrew Brockman.
What? Wait. No, sorry. Point of information is a question for the chair.
Okay. Point of information for the chair. Does Andrew Brockman and do other transfer students as a whole, as a general group, receive class council emails? Because I know I do not.
I don't know this question, but I would yield to anyone who knows the answer if you need to ask McDermott.
This is a continuing problem for class council. The class council is given their listserv, which is updated occasionally from the registrar's office early on freshman year. Therefore, transfers who enter traditionally have issues getting on the class council emails. The way they normally have to get on is by emailing someone in class council to be added to the listserv. It's not something that normally occurs. Newer transfers are getting on to the class council listserv because this issue has been raised a couple times. So it really depends on the case by case. But it is an issue for transfer students.
Okay, there's a call to question. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any dissent? Okay, we're just going to do a hand vote. This isn't a formal resolution or anything. We just wanted an approval. So all in favor of giving Representative Brockman the go-ahead and submitting this to the registrar, please raise your hand now. Raise them high and leave them up. Like, elbow not on the table. All opposed? Abstentions? What did you have? I had 19-1-0. All in favor, please raise your hand one more time. Nice and high. Not high, like this.
Like above your head.
All opposed? All opposed? All opposed.
Sorry.
Abstention. 20-1-0. Okay, my vote of 20-1-0 is approved. Thank you. I would encourage those concerned with that listserv problem. McDermott, you just mentioned that they are trying to now get transfers on it. I would consult with the class councils and let's see if we can address that issue in another way. Thank you for bringing it up. Okay, next we have back to the email server changes presentation. We have. You got. Please introduce yourself. And
I don't work with a mic at all, so if I'm too loud or I don't do this right, please let me know. But my name is Greg Menzensky. I'm a project manager within CIT. I'm here with Beth Lyons, who is within CIT as well. We'd like to talk to you about the Ensemble project. Some of you may have seen the article that was in the Sun a couple of weeks ago about this. And we'll try to take you through its impact to students, and with the budget as time, I'm not quite sure what we have or what your questions might be, but we'll try to take the questions as we go along. Right? I'll have to turn around and know what slide I'm on, but if Beth would go on, please. Ensemble is a project code name, actually, for a collection of projects that will deliver new email systems to students, as well as the faculty and staff. For students, and what we'll emphasize today, we will provide to you Google Apps for Education and Microsoft Live at EDU and Exchange Labs instead of what we normally and have been providing for quite some time. These systems are more contemporary. We'll talk to you about how that works and how they're different from what you have today and what you may have on a personal basis with Google or Microsoft or Yahoo or someone else. It'll give you a summary understanding of what's planned for faculty and staff as well. A fair question as you receive this is, why are we doing it? We have the capability within our systems to determine or to look at and see where you forward your mail through the Who I Am interface that hopefully you all remember or use in some form. And we obviously can't tell where you read stuff, but most students or the vast majority route their mail through a vendor account already. And as I said earlier, the system that we provide to you today, which is named Osiris under the covers, most people don't know that, it is not contemporary. You don't have some some of the functionalities that we would like you to have, like a calendar function. So I'll get into a slide that will describe what those features and differences are, but it's a larger, a substantially larger inbox for your mail, different capabilities, including opportunities for your collaboration on files, and there's some things on the roadmap that will let you do real-time chat about files and things like that. If you have a portable phone or some sort of intelligent device, it's cumbersome at best for you to integrate within the Cornell mail system. That's one example of something that will be much easier for you to do when we deploy these new systems. There are similar issues on the faculty and staff side. The most notable one is that we do not have an integrated email and calendar solution. Are any of you student employees who have an Oracle and calendar account? A few. That's a real limitation in many ways for doing some things, and that was a primary factor in the decision to deploy Exchange for faculty and staff. And I should take a moment and describe why we're using Exchange. And if anybody in the room understands what Exchange is, it's the Microsoft system that makes all this work for the faculty and staff side. It's meant to not get into a discussion about Outlook or Entourage or Apple Mail or other clients. It's meant to be all-encompassing, although as a user, you'll seldom have any awareness of what that is. But that is what Exchange is. And also from the faculty and staff side, there are some units on campus who have their own Exchange deployment that's been separate from CIT, and many more who are asking that we move that way. So next slide. This did not come directly from CIT as one of our initiatives. There were two task forces that were charged with looking into different solutions. The one that became the faculty and staff recommendation for Exchange began back in 2007. It included cross-representation throughout campus, folks who were Microsoft fans and folks who were not Microsoft fans. On the student side, there was a task force that was charged in the beginning of 2008 that had student representation. I think we had something like 7 or 8 who were fairly active participants in that process. I'll take you through what the recommendation was. We did a needs assessment. Some of you should have received, if the statistics are correct, about April or March of 2008, a survey, 10-question survey about how you use email and how you communicate with different folks. Did anybody? I usually get at least one hand from that. But that was part of what fed this. And we also have spoken to different campus units about their needs. And then finally, we have, from a CIT perspective, deployed Exchange on a limited basis for the day hall staff and for alumni affairs. So we think we have our arms around all this, and we'll make it happen in an unexciting way. Okay? You may not know these folks, but the executive project sponsor for all of Ensemble is the Vice President of CIT, woman named Polly McClure. We have those directors. I am one of 3 project managers with responsibility for these systems. We have an executive steering committee that is made up of folks throughout the organization. By the way of example, the representative from the registrar's office is very active on the advisory board for student effort. And I'll make a pitch to you if you haven't heard this in some other form, but I'm a project manager, as I said, I'm a student assistant for Google Apps and for Microsoft. I would like, at the end of this, once you get my contact information, if you're interested in offering your input on things before they're deployed and some of the things that I'll take you through, very much like to have. I'm looking for a wide spectrum, a broad spectrum of input, and at the moment, the student members on the advisory board are leaning toward the techie-only side. So not that you wouldn't be a techie, but if there's somebody who might be more of a general user, that would be of great interest. Now, there's a bit of a qualifier that I need to offer you about all of this, and that is although we are prepared, we are proceeding with the technical deployment. In the legal sense, we have not reached the point of signed agreements with either Google or with Microsoft. And if you're we're about to get into baseball in the season, like Yogi Berra said, until it's over, or I guess it's not over until it's over. And we've been really close to both for quite a while, and there's a bunch of nagging issues that we're working through. So what I'm sharing with you has not been announced in the formal press release sense. It isn't a secret, but there's a chance that neither of these could be completed by the time we'd like to deploy. So please understand the context of what I'm providing to you is real-time information. I'll answer as many questions that you might have as I can within the non-disclosure limitations here. But these accounts, I should say that the task force recommendation was to provide you with accounts on both. Some schools have exclusively with Google or exclusively with Microsoft. We have followed the example of some other schools who have chosen to deploy both. And you'll see, once we get into the few slides down, there are advantages or disadvantages, in our opinion, against each service, and we would like you to have the opportunity to make your own choice as to what you'd like to do. All right? And there really is no downside except a little bit more complexity on the way we set this up. The vendor business model for these services is to provide these for free. There's a Cornell branding. Your NetID will remain, or your email address will remain as netid@cornell.edu. There is no change there. You have many more incremental features on these systems than what we provide to you today. But the catch is that after you graduate and we update the vendor with a profile, I think, twice a year, that your type is no longer student but is alumni, they have the opportunity to present advertisements to you on these interfaces. These are not huge ads. I guess it's not unlike what Facebook does now, as maybe one of the analogies. But their business model is that they can tell their advertisers that they reach Ivy League graduates with these services. So one other thing about this that's advantageous to you, and I'm not sure if you know this, but after you graduate, your existing email account goes away, and you need to take steps by October, let's say, if you graduate in May, for moving your email off of your existing Cornell account or legacy of the system. On these accounts, you keep them. You don't have to deal with that hassle anymore. Okay, and again, your NetID will remain, or your email address will remain as it is today. My most important project deadline for my sponsors is to have the systems in place that provision these accounts to incoming students who, as I understand it, this year, the earliest where they can make their deposit or commit to the university is April 1st. And that's against an August fall enrollment or fall arrival on campus. So that is my most critical deadline, because that's a hard date and time. We plan to make these systems available to existing students like yourself around that date, a little earlier perhaps, a little later, but my most critical milestone in the project sense is that it's the first milestone. Okay. This is a summary of the capabilities of the products. Just as a show of hands, how many of you already have a Google account? Okay, that again is what we typically see in a conversation like this. These accounts are essentially the same. They're governed by a Cornell contract, so there's some things in a legal sense that are different, but the functionality is a little bit simpler in that on some of the collaboration things, for example, they're easier to do within the Cornell.edu domain, like as I presume your classmates would all be. One simple example that I use to compare the two services, if you've used Google Docs with any sort of complex Word file, with any complex in formatting, with bullets or headings or tabs, and you put it into Google Docs, it doesn't just save it, it'll reformat it as a Google document. When you bring it back out, and I presume that you use the sort of ubiquitous Microsoft Office tools here, right? That formatting is often munged, and it's a real pain. So I'm not here to be a proponent for one or the other, but just in the way of comparison, the Microsoft product has a file store that functions with the marketing name of SkyDrive. So in that system, you can save a Google document, an Office document, an Open file, an Open Office document, and it's file type agnostic. That's the kind of thing where we didn't want to choose one way or the other and then have you guys ask us why we didn't offer the other one. The other point of this is that in offering both, you as the customer of these services will benefit as they compete with one another. Okay? Next slide then. This is a quick mock-up. There will be a little customization for these slides or for these pages. At the moment, University Communications is recommending that solid red bar with the seal. We had thought they might do something a bit more interesting, but that's what they come back with. It's their decision, it's not ours. The next one. This is what's called Outlook, or it's really Exchange Labs. But if I ask you, either through summer employment or some other experience, how many of you use Outlook? Okay, that again is an interesting thing. Because what Outlook Exchange Labs, what Exchange Labs is here is essentially web Outlook. And it really is that under the cover. So, again, for discussion, for comparison purposes, not for pros or cons, the Microsoft solution is a bit more business-like, perhaps, and a little less cutesy on some of the gadgets and widgets and things, but it's a powerful tool, and it is essentially equivalent to what is known as Outlook Web Apps. And then finally, just go back to that, our opportunity to logo that will be not as great. What's up there is Exchange Labs. If you can see it, will essentially be the Cornell seal and the red bar effect. Okay. This page is one that I'd like to take you through in a very stepwise way and get your reaction or at least your understanding of. The way that we're planning on working this for you to move to one of these accounts, and as a reminder, each student, really every student, whether you're a PhD or undergrad or whatever, you'll be provisioned on both accounts. When that is available to you, you will go into the Who I Am interface that's being modified now as one of the things that we might like your feedback on. And you can select whether you want Cmail, which will be the Google Apps, or Umail, which will be the Microsoft Exchange Labs, or if you want both. We will migrate your mail from your existing legacy Cornell account to one vendor account. And I won't repeat that, but I will say that we're not going to migrate your mail automatically from Gmail or from Yahoo or Hotmail into these vendor accounts. We'll give you one opportunity. You can choose to migrate your legacy mail again into Google or into Microsoft, which we're branding as Cmail and as Umail. What will happen then is, as you choose that, you'll activate your vendor password, and the vendor account will be made available to you essentially as the next step in that sequence. Your email then will migrate sort of under the covers, and it'll come in, and you'll be able to go to a page where you can understand what that status is. Our expectation is that your email should migrate within hours, but we've not tested yet what will happen if 5,000 of you try to do it at the same night. So we're careful to not set expectations that it will be immediate. But that mail will all migrate over. That's one of the things that we're testing now. And we'll make the legacy email account available to you on a read-only basis for what we are presuming at the moment will be 30 days. And that will be more of a warm and fuzzy thing for you to confirm yourselves that the timestamps are all correct, that all the attachments are right, that whether you've read it or not read it, that comes over just as it should. We believe that it will, but it's an opportunity for you to confirm or bring exceptions, if any, to the help desk. And again, we don't believe that they're there, but we can't see how we could not provide you with an opportunity to confirm that yourself. Among the things that we're doing is we need to change the portal, a new portal, so when you go, if you look for mail there, it'll take you to these other choices. And then the final point I'd like to make is that you need not be on campus when this happens. I think it might be easier in our minds to have this announcement to do it while you're around, but you could do it on your deck in June on a wireless thing and with a cold drink. It need not be done while you're here. And as you might imagine, part of our interest is moving everybody over to the new vendor system so we can begin to retire the old email system. Okay, why don't I hold on that? Let's go back one. Any questions on that before I move on? And that, again, is the advisory board role that we would like, and I'd like to have more student representatives. What I would like to do is not so much test whether our migration works well, but does our documentation anticipate your question? Are we spoon feeding you, too much over here with things you don't need, or should we spend more time on the upfront stuff? That's part of what I'm looking for, and I think we're smart enough to know we don't know where you're coming from, and that's why your input is much more meaningful than us around the table in the conference room. Okay, so I wouldn't expect it to be a lot of time. We're working through test accounts now. It might be the kind of thing where I personally don't want you to move your mail on a test account unless we're real clean on it. We may invite you to a meeting in the evening around your schedule where you can sit through a demo and offer your feedback there. But that's the kind of thing that we're looking for folks to possibly toss their name in, and I'll follow up with you as we get further along.
Actually, have a list of folks with questions right here.
Yes.
McDermott.
Yeah, my question goes back to the alumni portion.
Yes.
We just got, a bunch of us just got back from the Cornell alumni meeting, annual meeting. And one of the biggest concerns of alumni was, one, the fact that they have to do the forwarding service and they don't like it and they're having issues with it. And then also from some of the older alums, that they don't use email, or they don't use email as profusely as we think is normal. So I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit more how this transition will affect alumni, and if you'll be reaching out to them saying, hey, class of 1950, you used to have to do forwarding service, but now you can have email for free.
Well, I can tell you where Alumni Affairs is to my board on these decisions, at least from a project perspective. I really can't tell you any more, but they have given us a tool so that when you graduate and you become an alumni, you keep your NetID with these accounts. They have, for the moment at least, tabled really doing anything with existing alumni. That's something that it's wrapped up actually a little bit in a tool that they're deploying for other reasons. If you've heard about what that is,
yeah.
The Harris Connect. So at the moment they are tabling it as they've tabled the question about re-identifying you when you become an alum at other schools, like that my school did for me, although I never use it. So I'm NetID essentially at alum.rpi.edu. So, and we're going to get killed in 2 weeks of hockey.
Anyway.
I still root for my school. anything?
Yes.
Yeah.
So for those like you saw, a lot of us do have a Google account already.
Right.
How would this affect us? Because so many of us use it already, and I have it to my phone and all that stuff. So would this mess us up in any way when you migrate over?
No, because we're going to still let you migrate, or you can still route everything just like you do now. In that sense, and in all candor, this is perhaps more meaningful for new students who are coming in,
gotcha,
who won't have had the existing account,
right,
the 300 meg limits and all that.
So we'll just be fine. We can.
Yeah, I would trust that our documentation will describe that to you, and you can say, I'm not going to bother, and I'm not going to use it.
But would it be to our benefit to because these have these new features like the calendar and things like that? Would it be to our benefit to sign up for it?
It could be, but we're not quite there yet. Example that other schools have done, and just to give you guys a little reference, schools that have offered both that we've talked to are University of Virginia, University of Indiana, and one that I know of that we haven't really talked to yet is Drexel. Other schools like University of Washington have offered one. I think USC did Google only. But within the calendar capability, we could, in a functional sense, provide you with the capability where you can pull down your class schedule into those accounts. I don't know if that's linked only to the ones that say we provide you with, but those are simple things that are not a first out offering, but that you could potentially take advantage of if they're out there in a couple of years. Yeah.
I just have one more question. That,
yeah. Just to talk a little bit about faculty, and that was mostly, I'll ask my question after you do your thing.
Okay, great. So you
have
a sentence.
Yeah.
So if I was to access my email from this email account,
yeah,
would I see both my Cornell emails and my Gmail emails, for example?
However you route it, if you route it that way, that functionally could happen. Yeah. It's the same functionality that we offer within Who I Am today is going to be unchanged. So it's up to you. You could do that if you wish. Yes.
Miller.
Thanks a lot for coming today. Just one more, if you could. My contact information, my son was here for 1 year, but it didn't work out, so I'm the only Mendeski in the directory. And follow-up questions, you'll be seeing more communications, especially after the, if you see a flurry of stuff, you'll know that the contracts are signed, although we're not going to announce that as part of it.
So thank you a lot for coming. I think this is a great idea. My only thing I would say is it's very complicated, not necessarily complicated. And I would caution you guys to provide a lot of instructions when you actually do launches.
Okay. Yeah. I may have made it sound more complicated by trying to share, but I understand your input.
And we also have a committee of undergraduates, CIT committee. So
right.
If you ever feel like you need to utilize the body of undergrads in that capacity, you know, PR, whatever.
Should be the best way to reach you.
Thanks. We'll do that.
I might miss it unless I hear from you.
We'll do that.
Cool. Okay, thank you for having us, and we'll try to take it off without making any distractions.
Thank you very much. Mike, would you mind introducing yourself to him via email?
Thank you.
All right. Trustee Walsh, sorry for the wait there. We have a Cornell Sustainability Initiatives presentation. Okay, thank you again, Ryan, for having me here today, and sorry things didn't work out last time. I'm Mike Walsh. I am one of the two student elected trustees, the graduate student of the two of us, if you will. And I'm a PhD candidate in biological environmental engineering, so sustainability and sustainable practices are, you know, something that's very important to me. It has a lot to do with my research. One of the committees that I'm also serving on right now is the, oh boy, I had the wrong presentation. The President's Climate Commitment Implementation Committee, and we are the committee that is currently developing Cornell's Climate Action Plan. And why is
That's perfect. Okay. I'm sorry. There we go. Okay, so for those of you who are not familiar with the President's Climate Commitment, and I know some of you actually came to our little student event that we had back in November. Thank you all for coming. I'll address that a little bit later on. But the President's Climate Commitment is an agreement by a number of about 600 colleges and universities all across the United States to develop a climate action plan to reach carbon neutrality within the next couple of years. And part of the requirement to develop this plan is to basically create an institutional structure that incorporates the development of a strategic plan to reduce our carbon emissions, in addition to developing sustainable research and sustainable education as part of the educational mission of the university. The first real tangible item that was required in the climate commitment was a carbon inventory, and that's a measure of how much carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases that Cornell produces. That was completed this past September 2008. The next big item that is required by the President's Climate Commitment is the Climate Action Plan. And again, it requires a target date for the institution to achieve climate neutrality or the production of no net greenhouse gases. Set a whole bunch of interim targets on how to get there, how to make climate neutrality part of the curriculum, and how to expand research. So, as I mentioned, we created this inventory back in September, and Cornell releases about 319,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide. 56% of this is produced by on-site combustion. So that's the all the smoke that's coming out of the Humphrey power plant just down the road. That's what we use heat as burning to produce steam to heat our buildings. We purchase enough electricity right now to power about 11,600 homes, and that's about 27% of our carbon footprint. And we also have, you know, two small pieces of the pie: commuting and air travel. And air travel is basically all the flights that staff and administrators are taking to do university visits. And it's actually a pretty significant part of our carbon footprint. And that and air travel is a big source of greenhouse gas emissions. So the Climate Action Plan, we're basically in the middle of our stage two right now, and really trying to develop the plan. It's basically a team of administrators, a couple faculty, a couple students involved in trying to shape this whole plan and to communicate it out with the university. I'm going to basically go through a couple of the, talk about the team for a bit, talk about the plan itself, and then finish up with a little update on the Student Climate Action Plan event that happened back in November. So the team is chaired by Qi Wang, who's the VP of Facility Services here at Cornell, and Professor Tim Frakey, a professor in natural resources. A couple of you might have taken a class or two with him. Steve Byers is the Climate Action Plan Project Manager. And we're basically focusing on a couple different areas to minimize our carbon footprint. Green development: how do we create green buildings? How do our current buildings, how do we make our current buildings greener? How do we build green? Energy conservation: how do we, you know, get people to use less energy, you know, to turn their computers off at night when they're not using them, to turn the lights off, etc. Fuel mix and renewables: right now we're powering most of our campus through coal. We want to switch over the next couple of years to natural gas. What's beyond that? Should we try and figure out a carbon neutral fuel, a biofuel that's a renewable resource? Transportation: again, another big part of our footprint. Carbon offset: we're not going to be able to get all the way to climate neutrality just by lowering our carbon footprint on campus. We're going to have to probably plant some trees somewhere else to basically make sure that we have a no net greenhouse gas footprint. And then we have these two other categories: one's called sustainable decisions, and one's called base case. And these two categories, these two groups, are modeling the financial outlook of how the university is going to be affected by, you know, certain legislative scenarios that are going to happen over the next couple of years. Everything that has a star in this picture right here has a student representative on that committee. I serve as one of the members of the PCCIC with Shane Rockmel, and we also have a couple representatives on these subgroups as well.
So the development of the climate action plan started with basically an outreach effort to the university, or the Cornell community, the community at large. And we said, give us your ideas. Let us know, you know, how you think we can lessen our carbon footprint. We took those ideas and we started to group those ideas into, like, you know, themes. How do we, you know, create greener buildings? How do we, you know, get students to use less energy? And we, you know, sorted those themes into a whole bunch of different categories, which I went through earlier. And we're currently kind of evaluating them, creating a short list, creating a long list, creating a short list, trying to get to a final set of themes to be a part of our climate action plan portfolio, our actual plan that will take us, you know, to where we want to be in terms of climate action, carbon neutrality. So this graph right over here is basically a view of Cornell's carbon footprint. Remember I showed you the first pie chart. We're currently about, right about here, that peak right there. And as you can see, this line represents its current carbon footprint. If Cornell hadn't been doing any energy conservation initiatives over the past 10 or so years, we would be up here already. And then you see this dip. That dip is the combined heat and power plant that's going up right now over at the Humphrey Service Building. And that's basically going to allow us to convert from coal to natural gas, a much more greener, a much more carbon-efficient source of heat. So, as I said, we sort of threw these ideas. We have a whole bunch of ideas we started out with through this web interface. We're developing them into a finalized portfolio. I decided to leave this little process diagram in there for Tony. I know he's a systems engineer, so. But basically, we're really, you know, working through these ideas, churning through them, trying to understand where the value is, both for the university. So we're basically using this decision-making process that incorporates, okay, does this idea provide an economic benefit? Does this idea provide a carbon benefit? Are we going to reduce our environmental footprint? Does this idea provide some of a social benefit? Does it create jobs? Does this idea also have an educational or research, you know, component to it that can push the mission of the university further? So we're basically evaluating all that stuff within, you know, these couple stages. And just to give you a recap of some of the ideas that we had, during stage one, when we asked the entire community to give us their ideas for how to achieve climate neutrality, our staff here sent in the most ideas. The students were number two. We had a big event, I think, on Campus Sustainability Day where a bunch of students came in and submitted a whole bunch of ideas. That helped us a lot. As you can see, this is basically disperses the ideas by their wedge group, what we're calling their action group. So a number of ideas were in energy conservation, again, turning the lights off, getting people, encouraging people to turn their lights off as well. And that's going to be a big area of how we move forward. One is basically, we're basically trying to take all our ideas, sort them out, that's the artifact or something else. And, you know, some of these ideas may have a big impact, some of them may have a small impact, most of them right now have some sort of medium range impact. It's a work in progress right now. So why are we doing this? Why are we, you know, trying to achieve climate neutrality? Basically, this right here is a table that was released in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that assessed, you know, the different scenarios that could happen over the next 50 to 100 years if climate change goes unabated, if certain steps are taken. Worst-case scenario is just a rapid increase in carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere, a rapid increase in greenhouse gases, increase in average global temperature about 5 to 6 degrees Celsius, increase of about 1 to 4 meters in sea level rise, and that's from thermal expansion of the ocean. As you remember from, you know, freshman chemistry, as water gets heated, it expands. That's not counting what happens to the polar ice caps and how much water that adds to the sea level. Basically, what the aim is, what a lot of people are aiming for, is this second category right now. This 2 to 3 degree increase in global average temperature. about 1 meter rise in sea level. There are going to be a lot of problems with that, but that's a realistic scenario that a lot of people are predicting right now if we take certain steps to do that. To get to that level, we have to the entire planet has to mitigate the carbon output by about 80%. So these are current levels right now of the carbon output of the planet. And this level right here, these lines going down off here all represent a whole bunch of legislative scenarios that Congress, that a whole bunch of other entities are trying to implement right now to encourage people to lessen their carbon footprint. How many of you are familiar with cap and trade systems? Okay, cap and trade systems are basically a way to manage the output of a certain pollutant. It's worked very well in the nitrate and sulfur areas. Those were the compounds that caused acid rain in the 1990s. They're trying to take the same theory right now and apply that to carbon output. And there are three, we had a firm, one of our consultants firm, basically modeled a whole bunch of scenarios as to what can happen with different legislative scenarios that are being put through Congress right now. And the moderate prediction is that by 2050, the United States is going to have to lower our carbon footprint by about 70%. And there's a whole bunch of caveats with that. But that's going to incur a certain specific cost to the university, regardless of any efforts that we do or not do.
Okay.
This is basically a plot right now the emissions that will be subject to greenhouse to these legislative scenarios. So these dark regions right here are how much we're going to have to kind of pay for or account for, as these legislative scenarios go forward. And what that is going to, equate to is, certain tangible costs to the university. This plot right here, and you were actually some of the first people in the community to see this. It's been presented to a couple of administrators. It'll be presented to the Board of Trustees in a couple of weeks. But this is basically the financial exposure to the university, or predicted, it's kind of fuzzy, the predicted financial exposure to the university under these legislative scenarios. So it's going to be approximate $180 million to adapt to these, to the climate change legislation. And this is a plot of just a whole bunch of different models as to the price of carbon. And that's going to matter because, as these legislative scenarios move forward, there's going to be an actual cost to emit carbon. So for every ton of carbon that we emit out, it's probably going to cost the university in about 10, 20 years about $50 per ton of carbon. Multiply that by the number of tons of carbon that we emit. Anyone remember that number? Exactly. That's going to be a couple million dollars each year. So the university, needs to take steps now to mitigate its carbon footprint for a whole slew of reasons. So this is one of the things that we're currently working on right now, trying to understand what financial model are we trying to use to figure out how much carbon is going to cost. How do we implement that into our financial decision-making process? So as we build a building, do we invest in greener technologies to make it more not only energy efficient, but carbon efficient as well? So as we move forward with this, we're going to also take an approach that not only incorporates mandated legislative market value to carbon, but also incorporates kind of a social responsibility cost as well. And what I mean by social responsibility cost is we're basically saying that we value carbon. We see the act of emitting carbon as a big cost to the planet, to the social structure of the planet. And by including that cost, but by kind of increasing the mandated cost and adding like a social cost to it, we are taking a leadership role in the way we're going to approach mitigating carbon dioxide, reducing our carbon footprint. And what that will do is that will allow us to implement green technologies sooner than most other people. So moving forward, as you can see, we're currently in the middle of our stage 2 process.
we're going to be finalizing our portfolio during the same time, stage three, and hopefully have a draft climate action plan available for public viewing sometime around mid-May, by the end of the academic year. Over the next month or so, there's going to be a survey going out to the Ithaca community, asking what sort of things that they want to see, you know, Cornell take undertake, you know, in their climate action plan, and how tolerable are they to certain steps that Cornell might take. So let's say Cornell decides to build a nuclear reactor. That's carbon neutral. It's a long shot. But we want to kind of assess what the community feels about building a nuclear reactor. Obviously, we have some concerns about it. So it's probably a lot of people are going to say, hey, we don't want it. Take it off the table. We won't include it in our foundation plan.
What is the climate council?
What else? Oh, so, and then, you know, we're going to work through a couple of focus groups in April. We're just going to be open to the entire community and then provide the information on that as it becomes available. We're going to be having April is our Cornell Sustainability Month. The Center for Cornell Sustainable Future is sponsoring a whole number of events. Some of them are going to be related to the Climate Action Plan. I encourage you all to attend the ISCO lecture. It's an environmentally oriented, sustainability oriented lecture that fills up Hall Auditorium each year. You have to get there early to get your seat. This year's speaker is Bill McDonough. He's the author of Cradle to Cradle and an expert on sustainable design. So that's basically it from the Climate Action Plan perspective. And I'd like to briefly update you guys on what we're doing on the student end of things as well. November 15th, we have this site neutrality event which you guys sponsored and most of you attended. Thank you for coming. Thank you for sponsoring. We had over 60 attendees. 200 ideas were generated. Our intent was to develop a report of student ideas for student-led efforts. And we're currently in the process of developing a set of white papers aimed at guiding students and administrative units in the university to address, you know, their carbon footprint, to address their environmental footprint, you know, in certain specific areas focused on residential life, student activity, Greek life, and other areas, you know, that might come up. So with that, I know I've gone on for about 20 minutes and hit like some very, very heavy stuff. I'll entertain any questions.
Great. Thanks. Thanks again, Mike, for coming.
Craig.
Thank you, Mike, for coming and spending us with all this information. I think it's very important for us as an institution to be environmentally responsible. I have a question in terms of looking forward with plans and ideas for the university. I've been reading a lot in the newspaper about Ruskin Hall and the LEED certifications and the various levels according to, you know, what is gold or what is certified or something. Is there in this manner, is there a level that we're setting the university for future buildings or of that nature? What is the best? I don't really know. I'm just asking for your input on that.
So LEED is the Leadership and Environmental
Architectural Design?
Environmental Engineering Design. And it's Leadership and Environmental and Energy Design. It's basically a rating system produced by the United States Green Building Council that basically organizes green buildings and accredits green buildings. It's a rating system, it's a standard, and you get the points for a whole bunch of things. You get points if there are showers close to the building, so you encourage people to bike rather than to drive a car. So you bike, you work on the sweat, not in this weather, but you get points for that because biking is a sustainable activity. You get points for building on a brownfield. You get points for using some innovative design feature of the building building, like sort of if we had some sort of external lighting light up this room somehow even more. There's a whole series of numbers of ways you can get points with LEED. Some of them were. It's a good accreditation. It's a good rating system, but it is still a rating system that, you know, it doesn't have the final word. About a year ago, the Board of Trustees adopted what was called a LEED 30 policy, and that said all new buildings that weren't in design or development phase, all new future buildings that weren't in those phases right now, Milstein was grandfathered in out of that.
would attain at least silver serum certification or better. And we actually were able to pull off a LEED Gold certification with Vile Hall. And we were also, and there was a 30 component. And this 30 component was basically, there's another set of energy codes that people use, that engineers build to design buildings. And we said we wanted to be 30% below the average rating. Use 30% and less energy than the typically rated building.
So then following that, I guess, that plan that was adopted for the teacher project, say, you know, he was going to be, whether it's starting to plan on being, for next year, and draw it again, would this meet that silver certification, or would the building have to be?
So certification doesn't typically happen until after the building is completed. And with Wild Hall, they expected that they were going for LEED Silver, but at the end they figured, okay, we can get a couple points here, a couple points there, and they made it to gold. I went to the faculty senate meeting where they discussed the Nelson Hall yesterday, and Kent Simon stood up and said that LEED certifications, the base level, there are four levels, certification, silver, gold, and platinum. LEED certifications are certain on Nelson Hall. LEED silver is a good possibility. LEED gold could happen, but not yet. Again, I want to stress, the fact that the LEED system is basically a rating system. Wild Hall, even though it's LEED gold, is using a lot more energy than Milton Hall ever will. Wild Hall is a lab building, and the LEED certification only goes so far. It's good, but it can only be taken to a certain extent.
Okay, Miller.
So I know every time I talk about this, economic times get worse and worse, and it is better. But like, as a trustee, and I know you can't disclose so much, but is it really how much does this current like in situation with our financials and the university going to affect the ability to take on projects that have such higher standards that in the long term will be better, but in the short term maybe is it too much of a burden, or is there going to be delays in it?
It would actually surprise you on how much some of these projects are cost recovered. A lot of the education efforts that we're talking about as part of the climate action plan, the behavioral change, recover their initial investment very quickly. We saw a presentation yesterday that cited an office at Harvard, the Environmental Compliance and Safety Office at Harvard, had put an investment about $2 million last year. They got a return of about $7 million. They were actually able to show that very well. There are some things that are going to be put on the back burner because of the financial crisis. Some buildings are certainly being pushed off to later dates. Redesigns might happen that might make them, less environmentally friendly. I really don't know what the... There's a lot of items around. But some of the steps that we take with this reduce our energy. And that's going to be an important thing because, as energy right now, it's cheaper than it was about a year ago. But it's, again, something that could pop back up. And the way these pricing models work is that if we build a kind of this social cost apartment, that actually, that actually is in a way a buffer to risk in electricity prices, risk in oil and gas prices, and it could actually buffer things out over the next couple of years. It's certainly something to be concerned as to the rate that things will go at, but talking to a couple of administrators, a lot of people are committed to seeing this stuff through because they believe it's so important. And I don't know if you're familiar with a document called the Stern Report. This was a report developed for the British government a couple of years ago, back in 2006. And it was a British economist that basically said the cost of doing nothing is going to be about a hit of 20% of the global gross domestic product. The cost of doing something would only be 1%. Global warming and global climate change is the biggest market failure in the history of markets. You might look at this previous one that we're in right now as a catastrophic failure. If some of the predictions of the intergovernmental panel on climate change are correct, global warming and get carried out, global warming will be the biggest market failure.
Salem.
Yeah, I think this is very informative. But I was just wondering, so what role can the student assembly take to help you out with this? I noticed, you know, some committees who are lacking student representation, so are you looking for that? Like, and if so, like, you know, how much input would they be willing to give, like, in the fuel and the removal?
Some of those committees, I was asked actually to get a couple students for those committees, and I was able to staff most of them at the time. But everything was just happening so fast that we needed people to get to those meetings, and it just wasn't happening with, you know, a couple of those committees. I couldn't find people. The timing just wasn't there. Some of the committees were fine. We don't need student representation right now. We're looking forward for more students and community participation in April as we move more towards the focus group phase and start to release the draft phase as well. And I'll certainly keep Tony, Ryan, Chris, and all of you guys up to date on that as we move forward.
I mean, the thing that Mike is doing with students to get ideas about what students can do themselves is critical, because we can't govern that, right? That's not something the university administration is going to go around and say, thou shalt turn the lights off. You have to come up with those solutions for how to drive that. Behavioral change is going to be the hardest part for all of us. We can work on, say, the librarians to get them to turn the lights off at the end of the evening, but there's lots of spaces that we don't control. It's up to the individual occupants. We don't have a good handle on how to drive that.
And Lynn has actually been working on my little student group, and been doing a good job helping me out with that. And we're moving on to our next phase of that. But your input in this phase, and one of the things I like to look at is our students' activities of the student organizations and how we can help them to be more green. And I know you guys are going into a review right now, and if you think about that, and if you think about start saying, okay, how can we make, you know, our clubs more green? How can we make them use less energy, use the right appropriate amount of space? That will actually make a huge difference. It doesn't sound like much, but when you get those 800-900 groups to do, you know, to do the green things, that will add up.
McDermott.
I was wondering if this is tied into the long-range master plan or different from it, and how those two are working together.
So we're using a lot of the stuff in the comprehensive master plan. A lot of the area, a lot of the space projections, universities are supposed to grow by a certain amount of space in a decade. That number is going to slow down now, but we're still using some of those projections in our projections of how much carbon how much energy we're expected to need over the next, you know, 40 to 50 years. We're also looking at, you know, how many students we have here, how many faculty and staff. Those numbers tie in very closely to the comprehensive master plan. And the elements of the master plan that we're focused on green design, green elements that we're going to be building on, you know, with this comprehensive master plan. So it's very closely tied. Campus Center is working as is working on one of these committees and very hard with a lot of input. This plan is, in many ways, could be thought of as a carbon master plan or an energy master plan as well, that augments a lot of the stuff that was brought up in the comprehensive master plan.
And then, just one other question, unrelated, but are you seeing any interesting interactions with professors who are adamantly opposed to, and with their research opposed to, something like the cap and trading system or carbon trading? We have professors in the ag school who say it's not working and it's going to move us in the wrong direction, and it just goes along with the market failure that's coming out of global warming. So I didn't know if you're seeing feedback from professors who are saying their research proves differently.
Are they talking about Reggie?
We have professors who say carbon trading is not something that should be a policy initiative on the global scale. I didn't
know
they were
involved.
Good to have
their
input. We haven't seen
them. This is just a financial risk if there is a cap and trade. It's not the end all of what we do or why we do it. It's just that's one of the things we see coming. There's lots of other reasons why we would do this from a teaching perspective or doing the right thing perspective. So that's not the actual driver for why we do a number of the things we do for our government. So if the faculty member says that's not the right thing, it's going to fail. If any of the legislation is something that they're thinking it's going to collapse in 3 years or whatever, we can still do what we're doing.
All right, last question, Latella.
Just real fast, I wanted to clarify something about the LEED certification. Actually, we have a gold building that's, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, the new Martha Van Rensselaer building that they're constructing is going to be gold certified. They had a sign out there for a while. Also, just about how difficult it is to achieve LEED certification, just to say that it is it's great that Cornell does have this initiative. There are only 16 buildings in the world that are platinum certified. So, this is a little testament to how LEED certification.
And WILE is?
WILE is
gold.
Gold. I don't know the number on gold, but actually one of the 16 is over at Ithaca College, their new business school.
All right. Thank you, Alex. thank you very much again. Any final?
I just would say, as you go through your decisions, this year, always be aware of the impact that they might have and use the energy or having an environmental footprint.
Okay. You all know Mike Walsh's contact info. You know ours. Perfect. Thanks. All right. Alright, thanks for hanging in everyone. We're almost done here. Last item on business of the day. We have a bylaw funding process and assembly expectations discussion. So what that means. Basically, just to recap you briefly, and Mezzi will chime in whenever he wants to as well. Been a part of these discussions on Tuesday, was it?
Sure.
We had that meeting? Sure. Tuesday Mezzi and I met with basically all of the advisors of the byline funded organizations. We didn't know that's what the meeting was, but we went and there they all were. And basically what they wanted to discuss was the byline funding application that groups will have to prepare for this upcoming fall. The SA will be reviewing all these applications as they do every other year in the fall. But an interesting question that came up was, what, should we know anything? Is there going to be a 5% cut in all of the groups? Because that's what's been going on the university level. So that question came up. And they want to know if they should expect anything. Just so you know, in the past, there's been no precedent for, the SA doing an across-the-board cut for the student activity fee or bilingual funded groups, etc. Whatever, they want information. So basically what came out of this was, at least in my and Greg's opinion, we do need to set some expectations at the very least for all the bilingual funded groups, partly because they are unsure. They don't want us to let them know that, there's going to be a cut in all of the bilingual funded groups come fall. Basically, they want to know if they should change the way they apply for byline funding. And quite frankly, I'm very happy that they asked that question instead of groups just applying for, as much as they can and then we'll figure it out. It's nice to see that the byline funded groups and their advisors are willing to work with us and we work with them as a community to deal, obviously, with all of this financial trouble. So, what came out of it? Again, we're going to... Greg, can you just quickly go over the timeline?
So the current timeline for the byline funding process is to have all of your application, budget, submission packet submitted April 27th, which is a little ridiculous, maybe, or a stretch for some organizations, like SLOFE, who's on May 1st, their event takes place, and some other organizations that have events all the way up until summer starts. So what we had discussed was on April 27th having a letter of intent to apply for funding due, where you would request, or where you would state what you're planning on requesting in terms of your funding allocation. And then that would allow the summer for the newly elected boards, advisors, to get all of the financial information together so that they're not giving us the best guess, but they're giving us actual numbers of what they spent in the past semester. And so what we thought of is giving the students a few weeks when they get back to campus in the fall semester and having applications for byline funding due on September 11th, which is a Friday at 4 p.m. So that way they have about 2 weeks in the start of the fall semester, 2 to 3 weeks, to get any last preparations together. They have some time to look it over in the fall.
So basically, this is a bit of a change in the timeline, but it's essentially a timeline that all of the groups and the advisors found friendly. Because basically, the fiscal year doesn't end until June 1st. So they're submitting all the bottom funding budgets, but it's almost the second year is almost exclusively projection, and it's just kind of inefficient. And then we have to come back here and we have to go back. So the advisors really wanted us to accommodate for that, and which this new timeline kind of does. Now, this is Appendix A, which is part of our charter, which is going to be brought up next week, right?
Yeah.
You have the breath back? Whatever.
Oh, I didn't like that thing anyway. There's a couple of changes, too, that we're that I'm actually going to be proposing with Appendix A. After feedback with several of the groups about the process and how the process takes place, so next week I'll be submitting a resolution with some changes to Appendix A that outline this new calendar timeline suggestion proposal that we have is something that's in Appendix A, so that's something that needs to be changed through Appendix A before we can actually put that into effect. So that's just a little bit where we are with Appendix A, but I think some of the changes will really make the process much smoother for student organizations and for the assembly. So I think you should all look forward to those.
Great. So obviously we'll discuss and debate that next week, but or rather we'll question it because it'll be you have to turn it on for all the mics to be on. So back to my original point. These expectations you want to set for bottom funding groups. After discussing, here's sort of what you know we sort of concluded, and I'll open it up for discussion, and then I will draft some kind of letter that will go out to the bottom funded groups for all of you to approve for next week. And I asked administrators like President Scorton, like, hey, you know, do you have an expectation for the SA for me? What do you expect us to, you know, freeze this and activity to it? The answer was no, but it was more so, you know, you certainly you have to be responsible during these times and play your part in being fiscally responsible, but without jeopardizing, you know, your mission statement and the quality of programming on campus. So what we were thinking was setting the expectation in this letter that would go out that would basically say, please apply any increases that you apply for should be as a result of cuts from shared costs, cuts from the university in whatever respective department, or it could be cuts from anything else, and maybe they had some private sponsorship that now that was cut. So basically there would be, so for example, I'm going to take, I don't want to use a specific, a concert group that's bottom funded, they've been having five concerts a semester. Instead of expanding and going on to six or seven, they're keeping it at five. Now if they were cut from university department, they need an increase to compensate for that. That's a viable increase. That's, you know, fair right now in a time where the university is cutting. Now again, we don't want to cut programming, but we want to, I think the goal that we were thinking was to keep it the same, and the expectation is that any increases that you apply for are a result of cuts and not because you want to expand certain programs. I'm opening up the speakers list for discussion. Nothing's final here. This is just really an open discussion, and then we'll come up with something next week that we'll actually vote on, basically. But the Student Activities Office and all the advisors are friendly to this. They would like some kind of level of expectation because it's unclear at this point. Andrews.
Just a clarification of what exactly, I know there's a two-year byline funding cycle, so what exactly are they going to have to be reapplying for? It's just the projected budget for the next 2 years, right?
What they're reapplying for is the, right, it's not next year, but the year after. So it's 2010, 2011, 2011, 2012. And their allocation for those 2 years. Correct.
So are we just point this? Mm-hmm. Are we debating what you just said, or just?
Well, I'm basically putting it out there that we're going to, the student assembly is going to put out some letter to the bilateral group saying, you know, hey, here are the dates, given the times and given a demand for some sort of expectation, we want to try to be preemptive in our planning for the student activity fee. Here is some expectations that the student assembly decided on to portray for bilateral groups. That was basically after the discussion that we've had with certain advisors and myself and others, that was sort of a very fair and responsible conclusion we came to, and then we'll be up.
I guess I like that idea. I think that's as possible, urge students as well to keep in mind the rising cost of the diversity,
Very good point. That this letter would go out to current bilateral groups, but that's a very good point. Basil.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I absolutely agree with Ryan's sentiments. I think that what he was proposing in terms of balancing fiscal responsibility with basically student activities and making sure that we maintain quality of student life is exactly what we want to go on going forward. So that's my two cents. Thanks.
Smith.
Yeah, I agree. I wanted to add that. I just think it's good that we're displaying it. I think obviously the group are expecting it, so as long as we just give our energy as well as they this is why we're doing it, that's really good.
Okay, there's no one else in the speaker's list, so what I'll do is have some sort of, Nez and I will prepare some sort of letter for us, to, similar to how we approved the transfer survey, and that's what we'll do. So, and then, you know, we'll be able to debate this stuff more then. Okay? That's that. New business. Resolution 23, Appendix B changes. This is new business. It's a charter change. So we'll only be hearing questions, so it shouldn't be too long. And then next week we'll debate, discuss, and vote on it. 5 minutes. Representative Stein.
So, just to clarify, there's actually, just so Hello?
Not on time.
It is. No, it is on.
Hello? Someone's probably pulled out. Speak loud.
All right, so just to clarify, there are no additional changes. This is just what was decided on last year and never voted on?
No, there are no additional changes.
Can you highlight what the additional changes are as opposed to the old changes?
Not specifically for each one. I mean, I can try to go...
Consider the ones that are crossed out.
No.
The bolded is from last year. Nope. Okay.
No.
Let's see. Slow cuts should have changed. So eliminating $1.25 for slow cuts. That's specific. The order is that either the slow pitch program reports with the FAA and planning the organization of this event. That would have been changed. OSU Cornell might have worked with campus related to planning.
Why is there nothing for EMS? I know we don't have to put a change for
that. There's a question mark for EMS.
Second page.
Men's.
Two thirds of the way down.
EMS.
As I recall, we talked about like how much they can save for an ambulance and that stuff. And we said we're going to leave. That was the way they were talking about the ambulance and how much they could save.
Here's the way down in the second page.
Salem.
Okay, so how are Cornell athletic events promoted? Because you're giving you read that in the third
they're currently doing that. That was something that was decided upon last year by the assembly and during the filing for the process, but was something that was never put into the assembly.
Okay. And also, the increase in the allocation of the council's budget to events, like, how does that affect the overall budget? Because you're increasing everything you set up.
That is a recommendation that was brought forward by that council.
Okay.
Just for some clarity that they didn't currently have, that's the numbers that are reflected in the changes are what they're currently operating from.
Okay.
So some of these are our statements and what they have done didn't make sense together. Some of it is adding clarity to that, and that is the case.
All right, Basil.
Also on the second page, you talk about athletics will not raise men's varsity hockey prices on the top of the second page.
Yeah.
I know that was a point of contention last year. Have we reconfirmed that athletics is okay with that?
That was
all. I mean, just with everything that's going on with the financial crisis, I'm sure athletic budgets are getting cut. And I want to make sure that athletics has the flexibility to do what they need to maintain the hockey program.
Good point. Andrews.
Where's all this money being allocated? I see that a lot of these allocations are going out. Where is money coming from?
They're not coming up. They're getting shifted a little bit.
So there's no interest?
No.
Just to clarify, we can't increase now. The only times you can increase violent funding groups is during the so next semester when the group hears all the violent funding applications.
An example of this is a lot. $2 allocation, $2.50, $2.50, which is
All right. That's all I have on the speaker's list. I'll let you Kumar.
Yeah, any of the amount changes did not come from me. All of those amount adjustments were things that sent from the group. Nothing in here is mine, really. It's all the student organizations that we met with, their recommendations and their changes on how to make their more efficient. I'm just kind of the outlet for them.
Okay, looks like the speaker's list has expired. Okay, we'll look forward to this for next week. No. Okay, we're adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.